Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We would like to wish a warm welcome to our new listeners from KSQD, a new community radio station in Santa Cruz, California. If you have friends in Santa Cruz, please tell them that they can listen to Your Call live from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KSQD 90.7 FM. Your Call is a call-in show, so we look forward to hearing from you. On today's Your Call, journalist Helen Zia joins us to talk about her amazing new book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai. As communist forces advanced through China after World War II, citizens of Shanghai who could afford to flee found themselves facing difficult decisions: stay in their homes and face unstable and dangerous futures, or leave and face uncertainty and exclusion. 70 years later, Chinese-American journalist Helen Zia tells the story of the last generation to fully recall this massive exodus in her new book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai. Helen Zia documents the exodus with details drawn from hundreds of interviews with exiles. And from these accounts, she weaves together the compelling stories of four young people who made the harrowing decision to abandon everything for uncertain futures and life as refugees in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United States. Helen Zia writes, quote, "In today's millennium, when more recent conflicts and disasters have forced millions of people around the globe to weigh the same desperate choices of staying or fleeing, the experiences of these Shanghai migrants offer a window into the current human condition." Helen Zia, the daughter of immigrants from China, is a journalist, writer, activist, and former executive editor of Ms. Magazine. She's the author of Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, and co-author with Wen Ho Lee of My Country Versus Me, the first-hand account by the Los Alamos scientist who was falsely accused of being a spy. Her new book is Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. And the last boat out of Shanghai docked in San Francisco on May 28, 1949. It's an amazing story. And Helen Zia joins me in studio. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's such an honor and thrill to be on your show.
Well, it's an honor to have you. And I've devoured your book, and you worked on this for 12 years.
12 very long years.
12 very long years. And it's so interesting to learn that, unlike stories of other mass migrations from revolutions and human crises, the exodus of Chinese, the Chinese from Shanghai in this era, really has yet to be told. I was surprised to learn that.
There isn't a single, not only book in English, but not a dissertation, not a master's thesis in English. And in Chinese, there are probably about three or four books in Taiwan, and those are only about the exodus to Taiwan. So it's pretty remarkable that there's really nothing, and that's one reason it took 12 years, to just have to find the information, dig it up, piece it together, and it is a forgotten exodus.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's because there were so many people who fled that in places like Hong Kong, when I would tell people what I was working on, they would say, "Really? That's such a common story." And I think it's because it's so alive and contemporary to so many people, even though it's 70 years old, that they saw it as just, well, so what's the big deal about that? And really, when you start looking at how many people fled, where they went, what they experienced, and the story of mass migration, exodus, fear, escape, all of that, it really is a story that should be told.
You also write that no one really knows how many people fled Shanghai during the early years of the Communist Revolution.
Well, nobody was keeping records about this exodus. We're talking about regime change and revolution, so the losing side had no interest in tracking how many people. They didn't have the capacity. They were too busy to run away themselves, and what they didn't take with them, including records and things like that, they just tried to destroy. There were in the city of Shanghai, at their headquarters and different administration buildings, there were fires going on all the time of records that were being burned or destroyed. And, of course, the communists, who were the new regime, they had a country in crisis to take care of, you know, to feed the people, take the garbage out, you know, bury the dead, and just get a government going. So the last thing they were keeping track of were the people who were leaving. So that, too, was a matter of trying to piece that together and figure that out.
Can we begin with a mini history lesson? Can you tell us what was happening during this time? The book actually begins in 1937, before the communists in China had any real power. But even then, the people whose stories that you tell and their families faced very difficult choices about whether to stay and face danger or flee and face other dangers. And they had to, you know, their families were split up. Who gets to eat? They had to change their identities. Tell us about what was happening right around that time in 1937.
So the reason I begin the book well before 1949 is because, you know, when history is taught, often we just think about it in terms of major dates, timelines, and so forth. But what leads to a revolution really begins way before that. And in this case, we're talking about the birth of modern China. The revolution happened because of decades of collapse, corruption, attempts to create a new society, a democratic society, or republican society anyway, and spans the birth of the Communist Party as well in 1921. And so I began my story in 1937, and I probably would have started it in 1911 and 1912, which is when the Republic of China began. But my publisher said, that's enough history. It's, you know.
Well, the nice thing about this show is we actually have time. So what would you have included about what was happening in 1912?
Well, so the story of revolution and how the Communist Party came into being was that 1911 was the collapse of Imperial China, the last emperor of China, you know, thousands of years of a feudal society, a mostly agrarian farming society with a peasants who lived under the boot of the officials and the emperor. And people couldn't live. People were starving. That's why the early Chinese diaspora of people from Guangdong province who populated the American Chinatowns and who built the railroads here and who, you know, carved out the mountainsides of the Sierras and the Rocky Mountains to build the transcontinental railroad, they came out of the collapse of the Imperial China because people were starving to death then and had to find somewhere else to live. So that was that ended in 1911. There was another revolution then, which gave great hope to the idea that there could be a republic in China that could lead to a democracy, and that was the goal. But there were many factions. China then and now was a huge country. Even then, was one of the most populous countries in the world. And so that Republican government, who in my book are the nationalists, the Nationalist Party. In Chinese, it's the Kuomintang Party. But so this Nationalist Party attempted for a time to try to build that republic, but they were incredibly anti-communist as well. And so as the Republican Nationalist Party was being built, the communists were and the leftists were a part of that whole movement. But the emergent leader of that, Chiang Kai-shek, who then became the you know, the premier, the head of the nationalist government, was staunchly anti-communist and mounted an extermination campaign of communists, including in Shanghai. I mean, in 1927, there was a massive a massacre, really, of not just communists, trade unionists, women who were feminists. You know, if you had short hair and you were a woman, you were assumed to be a feminist and a revolutionary, and could be imprisoned and killed just for having short hair. And so this went on for a decade and in those days it was called the White Terror, the white meaning that government. You know, the just as there were white Russians and the Mensheviks versus the Bolsheviks in China, it was the white terror of the old regime, the nationalist regime. And so for years, and especially in Shanghai, which is where the Communist Party was born, anybody suspected of having any kind of left-leaning politics was really a target for death and execution. And so Shanghai became a city of contention, of politics constantly in motion, of people being arrested, feared by one group or another. And then in 1937 comes the invasion by Japan. Mm-hmm. And there had already been a lot of battles, what they called incidents by Japan, that to provoke a war. But by 1937, they attacked the city of Shanghai full on, and for a 3-month period, pretty much bombed and destroyed most of Shanghai, except for the areas that were under the control of the British and Americans and the French. These were called the foreign concessions, and Japan was not yet at war with Great Britain or France or the United States. So those areas in Shanghai were considered to be safe havens because the rest of China and the rest of Shanghai were being leveled. I mean, the photos just show nothing. Mm. And so millions of refugees were swarming into this very small enclave, the size of about half of Manhattan. And so overnight in 1937, Shanghai came under martial law, under Japan, a very incredibly cruel and brutal, invading army. You know, the rape of Nanjing happened, forcing women into becoming so-called comfort women, or basically sex slaves to the Japanese military. And it was a horrible time. People were dying on the streets of starvation. The children I wrote about in The Last Boat of Shanghai, they were living in the foreign concessions. Mm-hmm. Their families had come from all over to find safety, and they grew up with things like being taught, if you see a dead body on the street on your way to school, look the other way or cross the street. And those were the ones who succumbed overnight. Then there were the living dead, the people who were the beggars who were so skeletal that they might have been the next ones the next day. And so that was the setting for the beginning of the book, this contention between the nationalists who were fighting Japan at the same time they were fighting the communists. And it was a society in complete disarray already and continued on a downhill slide under the 8 years of war with Japan, followed immediately by the civil war between the nationalists and the communists. And that went on for 4 years, another 4 years of martial law for the people of Shanghai, until finally it was clear that the nationalists could not possibly continue, and it was collapsing under it, that government was collapsing under its own corruption and its own weight, and the communist army was on its way to Shanghai. And that's what triggered for everybody in Shanghai who had any means whatsoever or who had an association with the old regime. They were like, should we leave? How would we leave? How could we stay? How would we survive? And so I wanted to set the scene mm-hmm. for that. In 1949 was the exodus, but what led to that exodus?
Mm-hmm. What were they most fearful of at this point, after going through everything that you just described?
Well, so most of these people in Shanghai actually had no idea what a real communist was or what the party was or what they were fighting for, because they had lived 12 years under martial law, first under the Japanese and then the nationalists, who all both those 12 years were extremely anti-communist. And so there were communists in Shanghai, but they were deeply underground. If they weren't underground, they would be dead. And so, for the most part, people had no idea what the communists were. However, the propaganda, what was said about the communists, was so terrifying. The idea that if you had any means whatsoever, it would be taken away from you. People, men in Shanghai and in China at the time, if they had money and could afford more than one wife, they did. So the idea was that they would abolish that, so they would lose wives, they would lose mistresses, questions about what would happen to their children, and the idea that the social pyramid would be inverted. So if you were not just rich, but if you didn't have much money, but you were middle class and you were a teacher, a professional, a shopkeeper, a lawyer, a doctor, that you too could be harmed by communists. There was a population of Russians who had escaped the Russian Revolution. The white Russian population was fairly large. And so stories of what had happened under the Russian Revolution involving executions and so forth, that also was something that was known to the people of Shanghai. So pretty much they were just terrified of, you know, after war and civil war and the collapse of their economy, it's kind of like, what now? And for the most part, when they fled, they had the idea that it would only be for a few months, 6 months to a year at most, because nobody believed that Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Army, which they derided as being, oh, just a bunch of peasants, a peasant army, how could they possibly maintain control over a country like China? So the idea for many of those who fled was that we're just going to be gone for, you know, 6 months to a year. So we can leave members of our family behind. We can leave our youngest babies behind because fleeing would be too difficult for them. We'll leave our parents, and not having any idea that, you know, the Communist Party is alive and well today, 70 years later. And for many of them, it wasn't until Nixon's visit to China that they could even see any of the relatives or children they had left behind, you know, 30 years earlier.
Hmm. Shanghai means on the sea, and you write that Shanghai's waterfront looked more like a postcard from Europe than from China, and it was thought to be too Western to be Chinese and too Chinese to be Western.
That's right. The iconic Bund, the waterfront of Shanghai on the Huangpu River, is what gets shown in, you know, any tourist postcards, banners, whatever, websites. And if you were to look at it, you would think it was more like a scene from Europe. And in fact, that was part of the foreign concessions. There's the British part of the Bund and the French part of the Bund. And so these are beautiful, ornate, granite, stone, Beaux-Arts buildings, Art Deco interiors. And they remain today. But during that time when they were being built, mostly in the late 1920s and the 1930s, there were rules that there could be no Chinese-looking buildings, no Chinese architects produce something on the Bund. And so it really looks like a postcard from Europe. And in a way, that's part of Shanghai's nostalgia, its charm, its mystique, that it could be this leading city of the world in China. And, you know, if you're on the Bund, you'll think you're, you know, walking down the streets of Paris or London. And then you go inside and it's like, you know, it's all Chinese. So except for the foreign concessions with their beautiful architecture and mansions and so forth, too. So it really is a city that combines so much mystery to it, and that was part of Shanghai's charm, and why Shanghai also became a verb. To be Shanghai'd implied something criminal or kidnapping, which Shanghai also had a fair amount of too, the vice and the entertainment, opium, gambling, brothels, you name it, Shanghai had it.
Today we're speaking with Chinese-American journalist Helen Zia about her new book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. Helen Zia tells the story of the last generation to fully recall the mass exodus in her new book. And she documents this with details drawn from hundreds of interviews with exiles. And then she weaves together the really amazing stories of four young people who made the harrowing decision to abandon everything for uncertain futures and life as refugees in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United States. And if you have any questions or comments for Helen Zia, we'd love to hear from you. If someone in your family left Shanghai during the mass exodus, what did they tell you about their experiences? When did they tell you about their experiences? Because a lot of people, as we learn and will learn, did not really talk about it until later in life. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You spent 12 years writing this book, and what a time to actually release the book, given what we're dealing with today. And you end the book by noting how relevant the stories you captured are today. You write, in a world fractured by turmoil, there is much to learn from the profound human experience shared by the uprooted and displaced, whether from Shanghai or Aleppo. And when you asked one of the women whose story you retell in the book about her experience, she said, quote, "I've been waiting for someone to tell our story."
Well, indeed. I mean, I had no idea when I started writing this book 12 years ago that here we would be today when the book is released, talking about children being ripped from their parents' arms and put into metal cages and not being allowed to hug or touch anyone. It's inhumane and cruel and criminal, I think, of what's happening today. But so during those 12 years, I was really looking at what would drive people to think that they were on the last boat or the last plane or the last train. And to discover that millions of people fled. I mean, I give an estimate, you know, not all of them were from Shanghai, but millions of Chinese had this feeling that the revolution's coming. We've managed to survive war and civil war, but now the revolution, let's go. And it's not like the way it's depicted that a bunch of criminals or horrible people are going to be, drug traffickers are going to be coming to America. Actually, the drug traffickers were American and British and from many other countries in the case of China, because that's how these foreign concessions were created, mm-hmm. by forcing opium on China when China resisted having that. And so, ironically, that's what these refugees today are being called. But in the course of really interviewing for hundreds and hundreds of hours people who had experienced this, what they say are they debated for not just days, but months, even years at a time. Should we leave? If we leave, what will happen to us? Where will we go? How would we survive there? If we stay, how will we survive? And I really think for most people, because some decided to stay, some thought, well, we won't be the ones targeted, or who's going to care for our elderly parents, or I have only three tickets, who would I leave behind? But the ones who decide to leave, it's really because they conclude that they will die and their children will probably not reach adulthood unless they flee. And that's true today, too. Nobody marches for 1,000 miles with their babies in arm, knowing that they're probably going to be tear gassed at the end of it, unless they think if we stay, our children will have no chance whatsoever, or to board a rubber raft, you know, into the rough seas of the Mediterranean from Somalia or Syria. And so that's part of what I think I learned and is a part of the universal story of exodus and flight and refugeehood. It's that nobody leaves if they have a chance to make it where they are. Mm. Why would you? Why would any of us if we thought we could? And it's only if we think that our kids are not going to live through this that the impetus to leave happens. And in this case, many people hedged their bets. They sent their children to different countries. If they had four kids, they sent them to four different countries thinking one of them might survive.
Today we're joined by Helen Zia. We're talking about her new book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will air the first conversation we had from an ongoing series of live shows exploring the connections between Japanese-American incarceration and modern civil liberties issues. In this discussion, you will hear from third-generation Japanese-American Norm Ishimoto, activist Grace Shimizu, and asylum seeker and immigration advocate Veronica Aguilar, who recently fled El Salvador. They will share their personal experiences, and then reporter Laura Morell will give us an update on immigrant children. That is tomorrow. And Helen, I just have to mention this because you were talking about the children who were ripped from their families and separated from their families. I asked Laura to give us an update, and she said in many cases, some of these kids will never be reunited with their parents. I mean, this is just, it's
heartbreaking. It's unnecessary. And I have to say that one of the things I discovered in the course of researching, writing my book is that I filed for a Freedom of Information Act request for my parents' records. And it took 2 years, but I got a stack of paper about an inch thick, and in there were their INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service records, the precursor to ICE. And my parents, like so many, and in fact, the majority of, quote, undocumented illegal people in the U.S., they don't come across by a border, walking across a border. They come by airplane or boat, and they come legally. And in my parents' case, they came legally with valid visas, but a revolution took place in their homeland. There was no place for them to go. They were displaced, and they were illegal. And what I learned from the INS records were they were slated to be deported. And letter after letter said, come to this hearing, come to that hearing, you're illegal, you're going to be deported. The last letter said, you should be deported. You are here illegally. However, you have some American citizen children who were born here in diapers. I was one of them. And because of that, it would be an extremely cruel and unusual hardship to separate parents from children. And this was during the McCarthy period. This was at the height of the Cold War. And this was a humanitarian, compassionate stand taken by that government that this one doesn't do. And yes, some of these children, they're already scarred for life. That's what we learned. Everybody who is a migrant or a refugee has a story. Mm-hmm. It took my mother 70 years before she could tell me her story. And Japanese-American internees often, couldn't tell their children. Yeah. It was their grandchildren who they told. And the same is true for Holocaust survivors.
Yeah. It's incredible. Today we're joined by journalist Helen Zia. We're talking about her new book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. Your mom shared her story with you when she was 74?
Yes.
Okay, so I really grappled with how to talk about this because I loved all of the stories in the book, but I especially loved the story about Bing Wu. And I was skipping the sections to find out what happened to Bing next. And then I found out Bing is your mom.
Right.
I mean, it was really amazing to learn that because you don't learn until the very end of the book. And I thought about trying not to give this away, but we really don't have a choice.
No, and it's been given away by reviewers and so forth. And I struggled with whether I should let people know up front in the beginning of the book or wait till the end. But, you know, I loved all of the four people that I wrote about, and they are real people. Everything, this is a nonfiction book, mm-hmm. everything that happens was real. And so I felt that I didn't want a reader to think that I was favoring my mother or something like that, and I hope they don't. But, yeah, I revealed it at the end to say that my mother didn't tell me until I was in my 50s. She hadn't told a soul about what had happened to her as a child, about being abandoned, given away at a time of war and crisis, and then living as a child who no longer had her parents through Shanghai and somehow ending up on a boat, the last boat out of Shanghai and then to the United States. And she never shared any of that because then it was such a stigma, or she thought, and the fear that people would not, you know, treat her as a full person. She was bullied relentlessly as a child, you know, in her early years for having been an adopted, abandoned girl. And so she didn't tell me, and I have to say what a gift it was that in her 70s that she did share this. And it was just, in a way, serendipity that it was. But this shows just how long these scars remain. Actually, it stayed with my mother all her life, you know, just this feeling, why was I given away? What was wrong with me? Why weren't my brothers? And she knew very clearly it was because she was a girl. But the feeling of being unloved by the parents she loved. And so separating children from their, you know, babies from their parents, or the traumas of war and what all of these children and refugees experience, it's something that doesn't go away. And why would we knowingly, deliberately inflict this on newer and newer generations? That is the crime and the inhumanity that's taking place today. And it's the little piece that I hope gets sort of that people open up to when they read my book, to think, this is what these people went through. Fortunately for them, they were resilient. They had the strength to overcome what they had experienced. And why would we do this to anybody else? And in fact, America, which is largely a nation of immigrants, you know, except for the native people who also have experienced terrible, terrible genocide, all have stories of trauma to tell. The people who fled generations ago from Germany or Great Britain or France or wherever, if they had been doing well where they were, they would never have fled. Mm-hmm. And so we each, in all of our family histories, have stories to uncover like this.
I have to thank you for saying that this is a nation largely of immigrants, except for Native people, because 99% of the sentences I hear is this is a nation of immigrants, period.
Right.
Without acknowledging
Native people. No, we have to honor the people who were here, and we have displaced them.
Well, thank you for that. Can we spend a little bit of time talking about Bing?
Sure.
Talk a little bit about her childhood and what she shared with you. I mean, I have to say that I devoured your book, and it almost read like a novel because the detail is so amazing, from the clothing to the smells. I mean, you almost feel like you're on this journey with the four people that you write about.
So my mother, when she did tell me in her 70s that she described in great detail a journey she was going to take with her father, something that she was happy and excited about because she was going to be special at 6 years old, going somewhere on a train with her dad, her Baba. And she was so excited about that until they arrived in the city of Suzhou, and she was taken to this big, bustling city where people wore Western clothes, beautiful outfits, Chinese women with curly hair from perms that she had never seen before. And then she was taken to a shop and poked and prodded. They looked at her teeth. They inspected her. She had no idea what was going on. And then she was locked up in a dark storeroom. The last thing she saw was her father's back as he turned away and left. And the door was locked behind her, and she screamed and screamed for him all night. He never came. And that was the beginning of then apparently the storekeepers, I don't know what else they sold, but they were baby brokers. I don't know, and my mother didn't know if she was actually sold or given away, you know, as an act of whatever. But in fact, she was then given away, and somebody adopted her, quote, adopted her, because it's not as though today there were any legal things. And she became one of untold millions, countless children in times of war and strife and economic collapse of countries, catastrophe, of children who were abandoned, orphaned, left behind, one of many, many girls. And I ended up interviewing other women and finding out that the same thing, similar things had happened to them. And for my mother, as heartbreaking as that was in her elder years, she would say, I don't know if I would have lived or survived if I hadn't been given away, because in those days, parents were deciding who would eat and who wouldn't. In many cases, it would be the boys who would be given the food and the girls not. And so that could have been one of my mother's fates. Mm-hmm. She could have been given to a slave laborer sweatshop. She could have been sent to a brothel. But in fact, a family adopted her, a woman adopted her. And so that kind of begins a journey for her that is still bittersweet, because every time she saw a man about her father's height and, you know, shape, her heart stopped, because she thought it could be her father. And she would just look at every one of them thinking, is that my father? Is that Baba? Is that Baba? And of course it wasn't. And even when she was on the last boat out of Shanghai, her feeling was that, well, that's it. I'm never going to be able to find my Baba again.
Wow. Helen Zia talking about Bing Wu, who is her mother, and she tells a beautiful, harrowing story about Bing and three other young people who left Shanghai for Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United States. Helen Zia's amazing new book is Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Justine writes on Facebook, Helen is talking about a time my paternal grandparents survived and lived. These are details and larger contexts. I never really got to hear from them before they passed away, so I really appreciate this. Thanks for having Helen on. I will check out her book.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I am finding that out as I go along, because this has never really been written about or recorded, this diaspora. There are so many now, not just children, but grandchildren or even great-grandchildren of this time who had no idea. They only maybe had heard that, you know, grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle had fled on the last boat.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's one of the really heartwarming things for me to find that this fills in a gap for so many people as well.
Well, thank you for the comment, Justine. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Pamela in Oakland. Hi, Pamela. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My favorite acupuncture teacher in San Francisco in the mid-80s would have been governor of Shanghai had the communists not taken over. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and his three sisters got out during the last boat to Shanghai. I think through Taiwan and probably through the help of the Presbyterian Church. However, he stayed, and I'm not sure why, but he was punished severely for being Christian and educated and well-connected. He was the most amazing artist I've ever seen of traditional Chinese art. And he was the head violinist or viola player in the Shanghai Symphony. And during the Cultural Revolution, his entire library was taken into the middle of the street and burned, and the teenagers broke his Stradivarius over their knees and threw it into the fire.
Mm.
When I was in Shanghai, in just before Tiananmen Square, I went to see his best friend, who was probably the most eloquent, elegant, educated, sort of Mandarin polyglot I've ever encountered, and I unfortunately could not meet him in person because he had gone off at 5 a.m. to work in a horrible slave-type factory. He spoke multiple languages, hadn't spoken English in over 40 or 50 years, and yet it was perfect. And the handwriting, that he wrote up some things for that I shared with people, including a PhD from Taiwan who said she'd never seen such beautiful and eloquent Chinese writing. So the head of the Chinese culture was cut off to feed the belly during the communist time. And it seems like they're still at it. It doesn't seem like they've brought their culture back anywhere close to what it was previously, nor the diversity of, you know, how people could live before the communists took over.
Well, Pamela, thank you for calling and sharing that story. Helen?
Thank you, Pamela. And I have to say that the story you recount of your acupuncturist's family and the man who might have become governor of the Jiangsu province and Shanghai area is a story I've heard over and over again from the people I interviewed, their families. These are the people who left, who fled, who had the ability somehow to do so. And most of them had family who left behind. And the fact that they had relatives who were abroad, who lived with imperialist under imperialist rule, or who had gone to Taiwan, which was is today considered a renegade province of China, and that was where the collapsing ancient regime, the nationalist, went. Anybody with those connections during the Cultural Revolution were a suspect. And I do want to say that there were different factions within China, still are, and so not everybody agreed with the way, you know, the middle class or professionals or educated people were treated during the Cultural Revolution. And in fact, if they disagreed, they too might have suffered. Zhou Enlai, who was a much beloved premier, kind of Chairman Mao's number two man, was considered to be, he was quite an intellectual himself, had studied in France, and he was seen to be a protector of many of the Chinese who studied abroad were exhorted to come back, because this created, the revolution and the exodus created quite a brain drain for China, because people, you know, intellectuals who had maybe no money, but they had intellectual capital, they had the resources of knowing world geopolitics, where they could go with maybe a skill that they might be able to use somewhere else to survive, they were fleeing. And it was very clear to Zhou Enlai in the Communist Party that China needed these people. And during this time that my book covers, there were letters directly from Zhou Enlai or from their families at the urging of the Chinese Communist Party saying, come back, come back, come back. You'll be treated well. We need you to rebuild China. We need you. We need your skills. And so many people came back or wanted to come back in the United States because of the way immigration, and even though there was anti-Chinese, anti-immigrant xenophobia going on in the 1950s and terrible anti-communism, of the people in the sciences, the STEM areas, science, technology, people who had any kind of educations in chemistry, physics, engineering, who wanted to go back, they were forbidden to go back. So they were kept many times involuntarily. And so in the National Archives, there are letters from Chinese who were here in the U.S. saying, we want to leave, and they being told that they could not, because they would be taking that knowledge, their intellectual capital, back to China, which was then viewed, of course, as a communist enemy. But this whole so within China, there were different views on how to treat people. But during the Cultural Revolution, things really went totally haywire. Even the Communist Party today acknowledges that mistakes were made during the Cultural Revolution, That Chairman Mao was 70% correct, but with the Cultural Revolution, he was 30% incorrect. Now, how they come to that calculation is one thing, but as Pamela noted, China is now still at a point of trying to recover some of the culture that was destroyed then. Things like respecting your elders. That is such a huge part of Chinese culture. Mm. And there are newspaper articles, debates that go on in China today. How do we inculcate a new sense of behavior, of traditions in China when so much of that was destroyed? And so that is a current and live debate going on in China. And one wonders whether that's going to swing to the other end, because the revolution did say women should be equal. Women hold up half the sky. Today, under this new culture with really, you know, a sort of capitalist idea of whatever sells is good, to be rich is glorious, now you can see ads in newspapers, you know, for somebody to be, you know, a lawyer, but you must be so tall, you must be attractive, you must be, and they define what appearances women in particular should look. If you look at the pictures of the Central Committee and the Communist Party, it's pretty much all male except maybe one or two women. And so the equality of women may be something that really looks like it's sort of gone by the wayside too. Mm. And so there are many things that were attempted to do under the revolution that were not bad ideas. You know, let's make everybody equal. Let's give people the right to live and eat. And that's a human right under China, to be able to eat. And so those weren't bad ideas. However, there were many things and incredible harm and damage that was inflicted on people and lives that were taken away, too.
Going back to what you said about people in the U.S. who wanted to go back to China but couldn't, the United States did not let scientists leave to go back?
Absolutely. There were, in congressional records and debates, a little office in the State Department finally had the job of evaluating whether people who wished to leave and go back to China, where their families were, some of them, their wives and children were still in China. And so because with the revolution, relations between the U.S. and China ended, it created a terrible turmoil for the Chinese who were here as students, you know, graduate students, professionals who were on an exchange of something. And there were about 7,000 to 10,000 of those individuals who were Chinese nationals who were in the U.S. who wanted to go back. And, well, not all 10,000 wanted to go back, but there were about 10,000 altogether. And many did want to go back. But anyone who had, and it's almost humorous to see that, well, they majored in history or they majored in English, they can go. You know, we don't care about them. But no, the chemistry majors, the mechanical engineering people, the physicists, no way. They have to stay. Mm-hmm. And there are stories of people who wanted to go back so much to rebuild China that they actually crossed the Canadian border. They went in a very circuitous way to go back and to aid China, to aid the Chinese people, or to aid the revolution. So that was something that was a dynamic that went on here.
Helen, we have just a couple minutes left. You interviewed hundreds of people for this book over the course of 12 years. How did you find them?
Oh, well, that was my first challenge. And so through every means necessary and that I could find, word of mouth, becoming a very annoying person that everybody I met, whether they were Chinese or not, if they had any possibility of knowing somebody, I would ask them, who do you know? Tell me about their stories. When did they leave China? Would they be willing to talk to me? Could you give me a contact for them? And, you know, 12 years ago, social media was not quite what it is today. Mm. It's not like I could put out a public blast or something like that. And pretty much that's how I started. There are networks of people So of every migrant and refugee and immigrant, they have some kind of networks that help support them, and that might be as nail parlor workers who know each other. Well, so with the Shanghai diaspora, too, there were schoolmate connections, church connections, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was so wide of an exodus that actually it didn't take long before I would find, you know, within 2 degrees of separation, somebody who knew somebody.
What an amazing experience for you, given your mom's experience and then talking to hundreds of people about their experience. Everybody has a story, but was there a thread or something that really stood out that you heard over and over again? And unfortunately, we only have about a minute left.
Well, the thread is how difficult it was for every one of them, not just to come to the decision or their families to come to the decision to flee, but when they did flee, these people, no matter how wealthy or well-connected they had been in China or how educated they were, wherever they fled, they were unwelcome. And so these Shanghainese, the most sophisticated city in Asia and one of the top cities of the world, they weren't welcome. Whether they came to the United States, Hong Kong, Taiwan, or any number of places in Southeast Asia, they ended up, in some cases, facing pogroms, where there were massacres of people from these areas. Mm-hmm. They faced terrible laws here and discrimination, racism, where they went. And that was something that they share with refugees, immigrants, migrants from any time. That it was a common thread and all too common, unfortunately, today.
Mm. Well, Helen, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for writing this incredible book.
Oh, Rose, thank you. It was such an honor to be here with you today.
It was an honor to have you, and I devoured your book. I hope you can read Helen's book. Helen Zia is author of Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. You can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. And huge thanks to Ethan Elkind and Renee Kemp for hosting while I was on vacation. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.